guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we run the, I guess we've done for lots of years. We've got some packages on there tonight. I may have to go over to the other input.
Okay, I heard TGW
And then a double, somebody said, checking into the net. Now, who was that?
King Bravo 2, Alpha Golf Papa John, get call Florida with a no. Get in.
King Bravo 2, Alpha Golf Papa in Florida. And I think you said you're just checking in, but maybe you don't have a question or a comment. And tell me your name, sir.
So it's John, you're at Ocean Hotel November with a no on any question.
Okay, John. Okay, let's start off with Rich, WP2GXM. You're number one on the runway. Take your sweet time, Rich, because we not a whole lot of check-ins so far. You got it, Rich.
J2RIW in the group, WB2 Golf X-ray Mike. Thank you, Dick. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. But on my continuing quest for the perfect TR switch for QSK, Andy was very kind enough to share with me an article from the December 2018 QSD about a TR switch that uses RF sensing to turn itself on. This would mean that the relay, there's a mechanical relay in this thing, and the relay contacts are hot switched on make. When the transmitter stops transmitting, the relay releases, so there is no hot switching on break. Now, I always read that hot switching of any type is taboo. So what do you think about this TR switch that hot switches on make? And also, for the few milliseconds between switching, the receiver is exposed to 100 watts of RF inside the box, not necessarily directly connected to it, but that bothers me as well. WB2GXM.
I'm with you, Rich, and I've got definite concerns about that. Among the people who I've often talked to, the moonbounce operators, hot switching of a relay, an electromechanical relay, they have found a lot of disadvantages of it. First of all, it takes something like 10 or 20 milliseconds to move an electronic to electromechanical relay. So for 10 or 20 milliseconds, it's in the receive mode with the transmitter blasting into the transmitter port of the relay. And as the lead of the relay, the electromechanical relay, moves, when it's halfway between the transmit's position and the receive position, it's got significant amount of coupling to both. In other words, your all three ports, your receiver, your transmitter, and your antenna, to some degree are all connected together while it's on the fly. Now, if you happen to have a real bulletproof, low-noise preamplifier that can, for 10 milliseconds, tolerate transmit power, then you could get away with that. Very few of us have got an extremely low-noise preamp. The low-noise preamp, the one that's got the low noise figure in the front end, that sets the noise figure of the system. Almost all of them are kind of delicate. So I would strongly recommend using a circuit that, yes, senses the RF, and with a separate circuit senses the RF. No, can't do that. Can't do that. Nope. You've got to have a push-to-talk circuit that gets sensed. It knows that you've commanded the transmit mode either by pressing down the key or pressing the push-to-talk button. It gives the order to the relay. After a given length of time or another set of contacts where it senses that the relay is now in the transmit mode, it then enables the transmitter to put out power. So the guys who have successfully done this have used that kind of a circuit, time differential keying, where the transmitter is enabled with a delay, either a fixed delay or a delay that senses another set of relay contacts closing. So I think you're going to be burning up front ends unless you've got a really bulletproof front end with a real good limiter circuit of some kind. I think you're on the right path here to be concerned on that one, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I concur, Dick. I've done some of the more research into the sequencing circuits, and that's how they accomplish it. whether they're Arduino-based or Teensy-based or PIC-based, they all sequence a series of events so that the transmitter is never transmitting through a hot switch relay of any type. So, yeah, you know what? This was actually a nicely written article, too. So, I'm sure I could keep on looking, but I appreciate the help. And Andy, if you're out there, we could talk some more. This is fun. WB2GXM.
Yeah, if you are using a tube circuit, which can usually tolerate brief periods of high transmit power without damage, if the front end of your receiver was made out of vacuum tubes, you might get away with that. With real field effect transistors, which are usually used for low noise preamps, they cannot tolerate transmit power. Anything more than, 10 to 100 milliwatts is hitting the threshold of alarm where you might be damaging your preamp, and full transmit power can really do it. And because the read of an electromechanical relay, when it's midway between the transmit mode and the receive mode, it's got lots of capacitive coupling, and it's really connecting all three of those circuits together with a few dB of loss, but they're all being connected together, and so lots of transmit power is going to flow into that low noise front end during that transition. So I do recommend you keep going. K2UIH, K2 Uniform Yankee Hook Gel, Dr. Alan Katz, who has run the EME News, Earth Moon Earth News, for 40 solid years. If you send him an email, guarantee he's got articles he can suggest to you of very successful circuits that people have used. Also, Paul Wade, W1 Microwave, I can't remember his call letters. Paul Wade has some articles, and he even manufactures printed circuit boards that do differential keying. I can't remember Paul's call.
W1 gigahertz.
That's it, W1 gigahertz. So, W1 gigahertz and K2UIH. Communicate with those two guys, and they will be able to bring you up to speed on circuits that have been used for years and years that are extremely successful. What were you for any fills on that one, Rich? To Vitra GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's K1GHCZ. No. All right, you'll have to repeat them for me because I'm a little blacking out here. Maybe I've had too much turkey last week. My quest continues. Thank you.
Yeah, Whiskey 1 gigahertz. Whiskey 1 Golf Hotel Zulu. Whiskey 1, that's Paul Wade, and K2UIH. Kilowatt number 2, Uniform Yankee Hotel. In that order. Send a letter to them, and there's a good chance you'll, or an email, a good chance they will be able to either sell you a circuit, recommend one, or give you information about differential keying that will protect your front end and still give you full performance. So, good luck with that project, Rich. You were right to be alarmed. And let's see now. I don't think we've got anyone else to sign in. Anyone else have any questions or comments for the TechNet tonight? Give me a call letter and your name right now. K2RIW listening.
Big Island, he's just checking in to say hello.
That sounds like NY2H. Is that who that is, Lou? And are you in Hawaii? Give us a few words as to how you're talking to us from Hawaii. NY2H, K2RIW. I think it's you, Lou. Go right ahead.
WH4YY, I was trying to check in from the east repeater, and I couldn't get through, I guess.
We've got you, Joe. Stand by, because I think Lou wants to say a few words to us. NY2H, K2RIW. Go ahead, Lou.
Thank you.
All righty, Dick. Yes, you're right. Yes. Puddle Jumper, where we are now in Kona, Hawaii. It's a little after 3 o'clock. It's 3:15. I'm talking to you via EchoLink. And,
Echo.
So, and it's beautiful down here. Like it's in the 80s, and we're having a good time, and we'll be there for 2 weeks. Back to that.
2 weeks in Hawaii. With 80-degree weather. Sounds awful good, Lou. I presume you're taking a vacation, although you might be there on business. And the EchoLink is working reasonably well. And I think I heard you say earlier that it was a rather long flight out there, the first portion of the flight. I think you said something like 10.5 hours of continuous flying. And so I imagine the person gets a little bit restless with that much time in one seat, so to speak. NY2H for any other comments. K2RIW in the TechNet. And I wonder what the VHF propagation is like in Hawaii these days. You got it, Lou.
Alrighty, Dick, very fine. Yeah, the flight was 10.5 hours, and you walk around a bit, you know, and you want to make sure that you have the blood circulating, of course. But I bought some. I loaded my phone with a couple of e-books. It's called Hacking Darwin, about genetics and what they're doing these days. So that was interesting, and you know, try to get a little sleep, et cetera, et cetera. So 10.5 hours straight through from JFK to Honolulu. So that's a pretty long one. Looks like they have fuel tanks on the wings. I mean, there's got to be a lot of fuel, which probably holds about 300 people. So that was fun. And there you go. Let's get back to net. And that's it from Hawaii, KH6 land. So this is NY2H, and I'll be signing clear. Aloha.
Oh, I think you said 300 people on the plane. And for your final, was that a 747? Is that the model of airplane, or was it an Airbus 777? So what kind of an airplane was that? And some of those modern-day airplanes have got all kinds of fancy electronics that smooth out the bumps. So maybe, although it's a long ride, maybe it wasn't, maybe you didn't get jostled around too much. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, but it was an Airbus. I don't know, 310 or something. I'm not sure the model of it, but yeah, a biggie. And we had a very, very slight turbulence, nothing to speak of at all. So it was quite a smooth flight, just very long. You know, I gave you a couple of different meals and snacks. That was good. So it was good. So I recommend it to anybody. Good. Take care. Back to later. NY2H.
Very fine, Lou. You recommend it to us. Okay, we'll consider it. Joseph, the B2RYY. How are things with you? And the last we knew, you were going to do some further propagation experiments. The B2RYY. K2RIW in the TechNet.
See if I can transfer without an echo here. Too much. My question is actually a very simple one. Has anybody out there ever come across a way of really repairing a remote control so it works properly? Like either for TV or other various devices that use remote controls. Anybody out there ever repair one of these things? Clay, take a fart, clean them up, and found a way that makes it work correctly afterwards?
GXM.
GXM. I wonder if you've done it, Rich. I wonder if it was the infrared type. And I presume the wafer buttons are what gives you an awful lot of trouble. And I think replacing those is not easy. VHGXM, K2RIW, that'd be good, Rich.
Dick, I have not directly repaired any of
them, but I'm gonna tell Joe something. Bring it over to Andy. Andy's a whiz at all this stuff. I recommend him like I haven't recommended anybody. It's Andy, WA2CDL. He's your man, mister.
Okay. You can also look at the output of the infrared type, of the optical type, with a modern-day camera, which will show you whether or not it's flashing. That gives you a clue as to whether that forward light-emitting diode is doing its thing. There are, back in the day, Radio Shack would sell you a universal remote control that after you bought it, and it wasn't very expensive, you told it what brand name and model number of television set you're using, and that programmed it to put out those particular codes. So, on top of that, with my old-fashioned Panasonic set, when I started getting trouble with the remote control, I just went back to Panasonic and bought another remote control. It wasn't very expensive. It was like $15, as I remember, $19. Just bought a brand new remote control because that's a frequently failed item. Most of the respected brand names of television sets will sell you another one of those remote controls. So you might be on the edge of trying to decide, do I go through all the man hours of effort to repair the one I've got? Maybe that's only going to be a temporary repair, or just bite the bullet and buy a brand new one. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
KB-2-N-A-R.
KB-2-N-A-R, start off with your name and your information, sir.
My question is actually really simple. If it doesn't work, that's pretty tough to repair these things electronically. It was more of the question of the cleaning the circuit board and or trying to refurbish or restore the contacts on the side of the membrane. I don't think they're like made of partially of carbon or what they are. But that seems what I seem to have with remotes. So where some buttons just don't work after like a length of time. Some do, some don't. That's really was a question to sort of aimed at. Back to you.
Okay. Let's see if we have anyone on frequency that's got any suggestions for that. Give me a call notice right now.
AC2GS.
Go ahead, Roy.
Well, yeah, it depends upon how badly the buttons are damaged or such. If they're really damaged, it's very difficult to replace the carbon conductive layer, and a lot of times the rubber will just start to go bad and lose its elasticity. If you're fortunate, what's happened is the actual metal contacts have gotten gummed up, and so the carbon, when you press down on those rubberized things, doesn't make a good contact. So the simplest thing is to take it apart where you see the contacts that the carbon film gets pressed up against, and see if you can clean it with some basic alcohol. Sometimes that's all you need, if you're lucky.
Is that Kilo Bravo, Bravo 2, November, Alpha Romeo? Is that your call letter, sir? Your signal is extremely noisy, so we're only copying you 10% of the time, so I don't think we're going to be able to get your information. In the case of my Panasonic remote control, which had a rubberized layer with all the push buttons, and underneath the rubber was carbon granules, and as the thing wore out, the carbon granules wore away. So it was a missing carbon on the rubber, and I think there's no good way of replacing that. So just the contacts, I guess there's a slim chance somebody has dripped some soda inside, and cleaning it out would be worth a try, but that's a rare situation. So in one case, you could buy the rubber covering. You could buy that as a separate item, or you could buy the hold-on remote control. I think you might be forced into that. Give it a try, Joe, but I think the chances of success are a little bit slim. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, and a tech net.
WG2P with a comment.
G2P, start with your name, sir, and your comment.
Sure, Dick. My name is Warren, and my comment is this. If it's simply a remote control, the malfunctioning one and bring it back to the cable company, they'll replace it for free. Those tend to be universal remotes, so, you know, it comes with a programming sheet that will, you know, indicate a zillion TV types and several of their cable boxes that they have out there. It's real easy to do, and it costs nothing. Back over to the net, WG2P Mobile.
TV2MAR trying again. Okay, thank you, Warren. Good information. Okay, MAR, is that Mike Alpha Romeo? Go ahead. QSL. Okay, I have a Sony XBR television, and I redone my remote twice already so far. I had a TV for like, it's going on 8 years. And what I do is I take the remote control apart using a Julia screwdriver. I degrease the circuit board. I take a nice lint-free cloth. I wipe off all the grease. And the actual, you're supposed to use a degreaser with a brush on it, I understand. The actual membrane, the rubber membrane with the carbon dots on the back of the buttons, believe it or not, I clean that off with a rag. And then what I do is I take that and I wash it in dishwashing detergent. And it comes out really, really well. Makes it almost looks brand new when it's all done. Of course, I set everything aside to dry. I reassemble the remote. And by the way, on the remote, the contact of the remote will jump. The contacts on the remote control circuit board, first use a lint-free cloth to remove all that gunk off it. Then you want to use a good cleaner degreaser that leaves no residue when it's all said and done. And make sure you clean it really, really well. And that, when you reassemble the remote control, that particular cleaning will last a good year, 1 to 2 years before you do it again. I always wondered myself, Dick, why the actual rubber membrane with the carbon dots behind the buttons tend to break down and get all gooey behind it and all that stuff. You know the reason why behind that? KB2MAR, back to net.
Yeah, that's a tough question as to why they seem to be gunked up. Joe, your remote control, is that for a TV or for a cable TV box or a satellite box? So maybe the manufacturer's got some kind of a warranty for it. So you've had some suggestions here, and I guarantee there's a way you can buy another one to replace it if repair doesn't work. But it's worth a try. I know you're a guy who likes to repair things, so the cleaning process certainly sounds like it's worth a try. To B2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
It's for an old Sony TV, you know, Sony Nobeloni, about a 1990 vintage TV. So I could possibly try to find another remote for it, identical remote, or maybe take the thing apart again and see if I can clean it a little better and give that a try. So I didn't think of using, like, dishwashing soap or something like that on the rubber membrane to clean up the parts that the carbon is actually attached to. That's a good thought. I did try cleaning the circuit board. Maybe I have to clean the other side where the carbon stuff is also. Okay, thanks for the tips out there, guys. W2ROI clear.
US2N.
WS2N, go right ahead.
Yeah, I made it through. Yeah, Joe, I have a lot of old remotes too, you know, for VCRs and DVDs. You can't, sometimes it's hard to even get a remote that does all the functions of some of those machines. They'll do some of the functions, but not all of them. So, yeah, I take them apart. And I've had luck with taking the, you know, where the carbon is, looks like it's all starting to come off, or, you know, maybe just the side of it is off, and when you push the button, you're not hitting that one side. I've taken a pencil, and I've, you know, pushed real hard and got carbon pencil to replace it, and that's actually worked, you know, because it's really nothing but one, you know, carbon resistor. That's all you got. Back to Dick.
I'm amazed that you could make enough of the carbon from a pencil stick, but maybe it was a very soft number two or number one pencil if you had one of those. I've never done the cleaning with dishwasher, and I thought when I was looking at the rubber buttons that I was seeing a carbon that had already worn away and it wasn't there, but maybe because it was coated with something that was fooling me. Maybe with the dishwasher washing, it would have done it. You'd like to think there's also something else you could put there, a small little piece of tin foil or something like that, because it grew on a small piece of tin foil in the right place. You would think that would make contact, as long as it goes up high enough to make sure it breaks contact. Because I think the thing works by resistance, not by capacitive coupling. But who knows? Lots of experimenting. So you're going to be doing a bunch of experiments, if I know you, Joe, and you'll be reporting back to us in a week or two as to what did or didn't work. In the case of a 1990 Sony, is that particular remote control still available is a little bit worrisome, because that's going on 30 years ago. It would be sure nice that the that Sony used the exact same transmitting codes all these years, and so that a modern remote control would still have some of those functions in it. And maybe that's worth a try. Buy a more modern Sony remote control and hope that it will talk to it. W2RY to take it with some dragging of his feet in case other people have got some suggestions. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I could add a comment. KC2SHO.
KC2SHO from the Midwest. K2RIW, go right ahead.
Yeah, Duke, real quick and simple, I just found that the Logitech series of remotes handled all of the, well, for the most part, handled all of the functions pretty well. I haven't found too many things I can't do when I program a Logitech remote to work my... The other remotes just go up best because they work so well. Of course, you can program things all in order and all that other jazz, but you can just put the device in and use it like that, and there's pretty cheap ones, and you might be able to pick up an older version on eBay or something like that, and they all still work. But the caveat is you have to be willing to install software, use that software, and the only time you can program it is when you're actually connected to the web. So you have to be willing to undertake that that portion of the programming. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some people out there who just love digging into software. I don't know if Joe is one of those people. What about you, Joe, if you got any further questions for John? That was John, SHO, from Los Alamos. Los Alamos, let's see, what state is he in? New Mexico. W2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I'm a repair person type of guy. I like fixing things, taking the apart. If I can fix it, I feel happy doing that. And I really don't want to bother Andy, because Andy's got plenty of things to fix himself. So I'll take some suggestions as they were put out on the net, and if I miss something, I can always replay it next week and, you know, like rewind the tape and play it forward again. So thanks for the tips out there. W2RYY.
W2AXO at info.
AXO, we're going to pick you up in a second. We're going to pick him up right now. AXO, go ahead, Paul.
Yes, I fixed my audio here. Is it louder?
Your audio is sounding darn good. Leave it the way it is. You sound good, Paul.
Okay, anybody who owns a IC9700, this is a new radio, the audio can be peaked up on transmission by changing the filter. Now, the filter, you think it's for just listening audio. There's three filters. There's filter one, two, and three. So filter one will make your audio louder on your transmit mode. So there you go. I think we figured that out the last time we talked, Rich. And I thought maybe anybody who owns an IC9700 might want to know that. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's not good information, Paul. Yeah, you and I were talking on the Airborne Instrument Laboratory net 2 weeks ago on Monday when you were doing some experimenting. I think the thing gets shipped with either filter number two or filter number three, and when you tried filter number one, the audio got louder on transmit. So it's a good thing to know on that particular rig. Joe, W2RYY, you're having trouble with your remote control. Is everything flaky or just certain commands? Maybe the most important one, up channel or down channel, or up audio or down audio. So is it certain commands that are giving you trouble, or is the whole darn thing a flaky? W2RYY, K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Well, I have a remote control on a TV that's giving me, where some of the buttons, like the on-off button that controls the TV, that you have to press very, very hard to make it do something. The other things like the volume up, down, mute, that seemed to work with just a regular light, normal press. Then I have another control used for a Magnavox DVD recorder, and that about maybe half the buttons on that one are starting to become a little flaky where they don't, you got to push them really hard to make them work. So that's what made me think about possibly trying to take it apart and look at the thing and see if I can clean up something inside there, one way or another.
There's one more thing that I discovered, Joe. As the battery runs down, quite often you have to press the buttons harder in order to get something to work. If you put fresh new batteries in the remote control, it could make an improvement. I wonder if you tried that one, Joe. Go ahead.
Oh, well, that's the first thing I checked. I take the batteries out and see what kind of voltage they are. I like using lithium batteries because they're a little higher voltage. They last a little longer, being the remotes don't draw a lot of current. So they're like 1.6 something volts instead of 1.5 volts.
Okay. You've already gone down that road. I had to discover that one. By the same token, my laser pointer, when the battery is not completely fresh, the push button starts acting flaky. But when the when it's got a fresh set of batteries in there, the push button doesn't act flaky, so it can fool you. Okay, good luck with that project. Anyone else with any information, questions, or comments for the internet, for the technical net? Give me a call that is right now, and your name, K2RIW listening. You guys are kind of quiet out there tonight. Okay. One last call. And if nobody responds, then we'll just go over to the science talk and mailbag earlier. Anyone to check into the tech net? Give me your call and the name right now if you've got a question or a comment for the net. Okay. Roy? You're on earlier tonight. You got some more time, so you can go through more of your... Roy assembles a great big long list, and he doesn't always get through that list. In fact, he intentionally plans a list that's longer than he could possibly get through. So maybe you'll get some more things tonight. And what's the puzzle of the night, Paul? I mean, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, thank you, Dick. It's a micro puzzle. It's just a little one-off type of thing. I couldn't come up with anything that had depth and breadth. But as an aside to the previous conversation, some of that gummy stuff is actually the decomposed and oxidized rubber. Natural rubber oxidizes. It also can be attacked by bacteria. And you need something like that to give the elasticity of those switch plates. So they have some rubber in them, and a lot of times, unfortunately, they will get gummy and decompose over time. I've had more than a few very nice pieces of equipment that were rubberized that after a few years, they become very uncomfortable to use because of that. Anyway, as always, I want to remind everyone, if you have any questions for Dick and you can't get on to the technical net repeater, we have a mailbag, so you can send them to me and I'll send them off and mention them to Dick. If you have any anything you want to pass off to Paul for the space report, either an article that you found interesting or a question that you would like addressed, or if you have anything to tell me. If you have any topics you're interested in me covering or questions you'd like answered or you have any puzzlers, because I'm always looking for puzzlers, or you'd like to refute anything that I say, I'm more than happy to hear references showing me wrong. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And there's already a couple of links to videos that I think most of the people will find interesting. I don't watch the videos while I'm talking or while Paul's talking, but they will be available at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, there's the chat room. That's at chat.ac2gs.com. And if anyone needs an audio stream of the technical net, they can't get on Echolink, they can't get onto the repeater, just point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com, and that will get you there. So that's the things I always like to mention, because people keep asking and sometimes type in the wrong things and can't find it. So let me drop for a second, and we'll go on with the regular science talk. Okay, I did a little bit of Googling about last week's comment question about how cold you can super cool water before it just freezes no matter what you do with it. And apparently the theoretical answer is -48 degrees centigrade, or if you're into Fahrenheit, -55 degrees Fahrenheit. As any good Kurt Vonnegut fan knows, water ice has about 16 different crystalline forms in which the water molecules cling to each other with their hydrogen bonding. The present theory is that -48 degrees centigrade, water molecules organize themselves in a rather tetrahedral chain. That's with each water molecule loosely bounded to four other molecules. This structural change from liquid to an intermediate ice then no longer requires any external nucleation sites to trigger a change in their phase. In the real world, where nothing is 100% pure and measuring things upsets the system, supercooled water has only been measured to as low as -41 degrees centigrade, which is generally called the homogeneous nucleation temperature. It's the lowest temperature at which the ice crystallization rate can be measured as water is freezing. Below this temperature, ice is crystallizing way too fast for any property of the remaining liquid to possibly be measured. The -48 degrees centigrade limit is based upon a computer model performed in 2011, modeled using real data. The researchers took thousands of hours of computer time to simulate the behavior of 32,768 water molecules, much smaller than a tiny drop of water, to determine how the heat capacity, the density, and the compressibility of water changes as it's supercooled, and to simulate how fast ice crystals ice crystallizes within a batch of about 4,000 water molecules. And I will have a link up there where you can read the article. It's rather fascinating. So we answered your question, Dick. Theoretically, supercooled water can go down to -48 degrees centigrade, but in practical terms, it's only been recorded at -41.
That's kind of amazing. If I supercooled my water to -0.1 degree centigrade and took it out of the freezer and tapped on it, I presume only a very small fraction of the bottle would go into the solid state in that situation. Is that true, Roy, from what you know, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick. You'd have to deal with the heat of crystallization. It would rise the temperature back up to 0 degrees centigrade, and you'd reach equilibrium before too much of the water had froze to ice. You'd have to get it closer to its lower point where the heat of fusion would not heat the entire material up past the equilibrium point.
Each time Derek Mueller of Veritasium did that experiment, he didn't have a thermometer in there, but I would like to have known what temperature he had supercooled the water at, because each one of his bottles that he brought out of the freezer, and they were completely liquid, and then he slammed them on the table, and the whole Don volume of water all turned solid, as I remember. I wonder what's the minimum temperature of supercooling required so that all of it, because heat of fusion, as it's called, 80 calories per gram, I imagine it's calculatable. You would think 80 calories per gram, and each calorie is it 1 degree centigrade? Oh, it's a certain number of pounds of water, though. So we can calculate, knowing 80 calories per gram, how many degrees you have to be. And maybe the answer is minus 10 degrees centigrade would be enough for the whole thing to turn solid. So that's something we could calculate and or test or research. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. I'll take a look at it. My gut sense is that there's no absolute number. It's probably relative to the volume of the supercooled water that you're testing. At an infinitely small amount of supercooled fluid, you probably just have to bring it 1 degree down below zero, and the heat of fusion won't kick it up to that equilibrium point. But as you increase the mass of the supercooled liquid, you have to then drop the temperature down. But that adds another little wrinkle on the whole thing. At another point, you're limited by the temperature. If you have to lower it to a certain point to get past the equilibrium point, you get to the point where the liquid actually develops into a pseudo crystal to begin with, and it goes out of solution. So there's probably an upper limit on the amount of mass that you can do this to.
You think it's mass, and I think it's temperature, because if you've got 1 quart of water or 1 liter of water or 1 pint of water, in either case, to go from the liquid state to the frozen state, a given number of calories of heat of fusion are required, and you would think that would be proportional to the amount of fluid that was there to begin with. Therefore, I think it all evens out to be one particular temperature you've got to go to have it all freeze. And maybe the answer is minus 5 or minus 10 degrees centigrade. It'll take any amount of water if you've got it at that super cool temperature, and it will all convert to a solid once you shock it. And I guess the shocking it is really making a nucleation site by some magic. I'm wondering why shocking it makes a nucleation site. Is it creating a microscopic bubble? What's your guess on that one, Roy? K2RIW.
That would be my surmise, is that if you agitate these things in any way, you're going to introduce perhaps a very small amount, but then all you need is a very small amount of air bubbles under the surface, and that'll be a nucleation site where the whole thing just grows exponentially rather quickly.
On a slightly related subject, people used to make ice cream at home by putting ice in a pail, pouring salt water on the ice, and then an inner pail is where you put the cream, and you were whipping that cream at the lower temperature. If you use nothing but ice, the cream would stay as a cold cream. It would never turn into a solid. You got to get to some lower temperature, considerably below 0 degrees centigrade, to really make ice cream. So pouring salt onto ice, I wonder what is the lowest temperature you're able to get to with that method. Will that get you to minus 30 degrees centigrade? There must be somebody who has published some results on that one. And what's the minimum temperature at which you can make ice cream? AC2GS, K2RIW.
I remember back in college we did do melting points and freezing points, and there are ways of calculating by the number of dissolved solid particles in water solution, how it affects the equilibrium conditions of water to ice, given a certain pressure. Matter of fact, Lou from last week was talking about that very experiment, where he was demonstrating to school students the the drop in the freezing point of ice water solution as you increase the salt concentration.
EC2IS, comment?
Yes, Bill.
Hey, I tuned in a bit late here, but I think I just heard the question, what's the minimum temperature at which you could make ice cream? Maybe you meant the maximum or highest temperature, and maybe you've heard of ice cream places. I don't know if they're around anymore, but there used to be one called Nitro's, where they would make ice cream with nitrogen, liquid nitrogen, I think. And I think the idea there was not only was it very cold, and it would, you know, chill the ice cream very quickly, but also in a nitrogen environment, you're displacing the air and any kind of moisture in the water, and I think you ended up getting ice cream without ice crystals in it. It was, I think, a much smoother thing. Just wondering if you'd heard of that or were aware of it, AC2IS.
When you let liquid nitrogen boil at room temperature, I think it goes to minus 70 or minus 80 degrees centigrade. And when it comes to the Nitro ice cream store, I saw one of those in Florida last April. They made it. They may have discontinued them in New York, but Florida still has them. Over to you, Roy, for any comment on all of the above. What liquid nitrogen boils at what temperature and standard temperature pressure? I think it's minus 70 or minus 80. AC2GS, K2IW.
I don't recall. I was talking to someone about it just last week, and I forgot. But it's probably something like 72 degrees, minus 72 degrees. The point is not so much that it displaces the moisture. Ice crystals will grow as you slowly bring the water to the freezing point. If you do it very quickly, very abruptly, it doesn't give an opportunity for ice crystals to grow, and so you get a very fine, almost powdery consistency in the ice cream. And I'm sure there are stores that still do it all over the place. I know there's loads and loads of YouTubes that do it, that show it, and all you need is a ready supply of liquid nitrogen and a thermos.
While they're making the ice cream, they're churning it, and by some means are they bubbling the nitrogen gas through the mixture? Is that how they're doing it, Roy?
I don't remember exactly how. It's a shame because I did see the videos. My memory is just the assumption that they're just mixing cream with small portions of liquid nitrogen and agitating as fast as they can to bring the temperature down as quickly as they can.
So you think they're pouring the cream and the liquid nitrogen in a bowl and whipping it as fast as possible, but just simply pouring it together in a well-insulated bowl is what I think you're saying.
Now, my understanding is it doesn't require a lot of technology other than the source of the liquid nitrogen and a thermos to hold on to things. But otherwise, I think it's just a preparation where you have either the cream with the sugar and the other things that they add to ice cream before it gets crystallized. And the final step is beating it and introducing small amounts of liquid nitrogen that will, you know, bubble out and just cool everything off, and then you're done.
In the case of nitrogen, there are maybe not so honest garage-like operations that will fill your automobile tires with nitrogen, and they make all kinds of claims. And I do know that military aircraft tires, they do fill them with liquid nitrogen. I think their motivation is that the nitrogen molecule is slightly larger, therefore it migrates through the rubber a little bit more slowly. The tire doesn't go flat as fast. And in the case of a military aircraft, you're sometimes filling the tires on the aircraft to 250 or 260 pounds per square inch. So a leakage rate is something you'd be concerned with. But and maybe the nitrogen in the tire also lacking oxygen means that you're getting less oxidation of the rubber, and the rubber will last longer. These are possible things, the advantage for nitrogen in military aircraft tires. Is there enough advantage to pay all these extra dollars to put nitrogen in your automobile tires? I think the answer might be no, but I'm not sure. AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2IS, coming.
Yeah, Bill, one sec. I just want to issue a correction. I looked it up. Nitrogen's boiling point is minus 195.8 degrees centigrade.
Wow. Minus, what was that again?
195.8 degrees centigrade.
Not Fahrenheit, centigrade. Wow. That's the temperature at which liquid nitrogen boils. Boy, that sounds like too big a number. I wonder if there's more than one reference that'll say that, Roy. Go ahead.
I could look it up in a different place. It's if you like Fahrenheit, it's minus 320.4 degrees Fahrenheit. I tend to kind of translate these things into Kelvin. So in Kelvin, it's only about 80 degrees. So that's probably why both of us think 80 degrees. We're kind of thinking Kelvin as opposed to minus centigrade.
You're right. They put liquid nitrogen in the cold sauce for a hot cold sauce for noise figure measurement. And the cold sauce runs at something like 73 degrees Kelvin. 73 Kelvin, the one that's bathed in liquid nitrogen. I'm beginning to agree with you, Roy.
Indeed. For anyone interested, oxygen boils at minus 1.8 degrees. And boils at something atrocious degrees Kelvin. Anyway, Bill, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to take some guesses as to why aircraft tires would be pressurized with nitrogen. Zick said liquid nitrogen, which doesn't sound likely. Yeah, sure, it's stored as liquid, but I would think that they would put it into the tires as a gas. If it needs to be at high pressure, you know, that gas is going in there at a low temperature, maybe that makes it easier to get, you know, a volume of nitrogen in there. It's going to expand a bit afterwards and bring the pressure up, so maybe you don't have to work so hard to pressurize the tire. Dick was saying maybe it's good to have no oxygen in there to reduce oxidation. Most of the atmosphere is nitrogen anyway, but I think maybe a advantage, or maybe the major advantage, is when when you have liquid nitrogen, there's basically no moisture in there, again going back to the ice cream theory. So you won't have any moisture in your tires, and if your tires are going to get temperature cycled a lot, maybe you're not going to have ice forming and vaporizing over and over again inside of your tires. AC2IS.
Yeah, if I said liquid nitrogen in the tire, I was wrong. Nitrogen gas, for sure. But to make sure you have nothing but nitrogen gas in that military aircraft tire, I think they have to purge it. In other words, they put in liquid nitrogen, drain it back out, put in nitrogen, drain it back out, put in nitrogen. So it's nitrogen gas at high pressure they're putting in there. I shouldn't have said liquid if I did. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul, one second. I just want to mention that there's a very important adjective we're leaving out. What most people call that stuff is dry nitrogen, and that goes along with what Bill suggested, that I think a strong component of this is not necessarily the oxidative effect of atmospheric oxygen,